Are there visitors from other realms attempting to help preserve our planet? If so, why? In a moment, the Keepers. Jim Sparks, our guest. Linda Moulton Howe will join us for this hour on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to be talking tonight with Jim Sparks. He was raised in Florida with memories of a childhood filled with very strange and interesting creatures. However, his childhood was dwarfed by the vastness of space and dimensions that his abductors had exposed to him. Jim differs from most abductees in that he has near total recall of his experiences with beings from other regions and dimensions of space and time. Jim was 34 when his experiences with otherworldly beings really started. Now, 18 years later, Sparks has moved from resistor to cooperator and is sharing his experiences with others. In his book we're talking about, Jim gives us firsthand reports of a decade of ET encounters along with messages for humanity. Jim Sparks. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Hey, it's great to be here.
Likewise, we're looking forward to this. And, of course, Jim, I'm bringing in this hour Linda Moulton Howe from EarthFiles.com and our investigative reporter. She wrote the prologue to your book, The Keepers. Hey, Linda, how are you?
Hi, George. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
It's great to be here with both of you on this extremely, I think, important book, important abduction syndrome event that I remember, George, the first time I met Jim back in 1995 at a conference, and the thing that impressed me was that he had had such a normal life until he was 34 years old, and then it was like he walked through Alice in Wonderland's mirror, and nothing has ever been quite the same. And I think tonight, if you can get a sense from Jim about just how normal his life was up to age 34, and then it was all conscious.
And Jim, now your name, because Linda, back then during that time period, he had a different name, right?
Jim Sparacino. Vincent Sparacino.
Yeah, it's Vincent Jim. And Jim Sparks is a pen name, and that's just the name that I've used when I started writing.
Okay. And you prefer to be called Jim tonight?
Oh,
Jim?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. In fact, the way it worked with me and my family background, my father's name was Vincent, and they put that on the birth certificate, and my mother's father's name, which was my grandfather on my mother's side, his name was Jim or Jimmy. So as a child, out of respect, of course, they named me Vincent on the birth certificate, but they called me Jimmy ever since I was a baby, or Jim. So yeah, Jim is fine.
It's a great story in the book, The Keepers, and let me tell you, you've got the foreword by the late Dr. John Mack, and of course you've got Linda Moulton Howe writing the prologue. Linda and Jim, how did you two come together where you, Linda, would write the prologue for The Keepers?
Well, I've known Jim since 1995 when we met at that conference, and I was so impressed talking to him. And over the 90s, we kept in touch. And when I started working on my Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness, that came out in 98, Jim and I had talked about he had a kind of a manuscript in some illustrations, and he wanted to have a book. And I was working on a book that had the big context of military voices, human abduction syndrome, and all of it. And so we struck an agreement that what I would do is take the story that he had then with illustrations, and I made it into Chapter 3 in Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2. So Chapter 3 is called Other Beings, Other Worlds, and it is strictly about the Jim Sparks story. And as time has evolved, Jim knew that he wanted to get out in his own voice his experiences entirely firsthand in a book, and The Keepers and a fantastic videotape that he has now out on DVD that shows, I think, better than anything that I've ever seen, and I have a long TV production background, of showing from the inside of a person in the abduction syndrome of what they go through. How Jim had his interactions going up into craft, and a bottom line about what we would say might be ghosts or translucents or things popping in and out of visibility, all of that Jim would describe as technology. And I remember thinking in the 90s, that he is describing with more detail because he's been so conscious than perhaps anybody that I had ever talked to in the abduction syndrome, and coming from such a down-to-earth, grounded place. And in fact, Jim, what I'm wondering is to share with the Coast audience, could you go back to that time back in 1988 when you were 34 and you were living a very normal life, and then something extraordinary happened, and finally you had physical evidence that I still remember from talking to you the first time really impressed me.
Well, sure. As you mentioned earlier, prior to 1988, as far as I was concerned, it was impossible for anything to be such as hundreds, thousands, perhaps millions of people being pulled or abducted in the middle of the night, perhaps in the day, in their car, whoever it was, missing time all over the globe. In fact, the thought of anything like that never entered my mind. At the time, I had two businesses going. Both of them were doing well, and I started them from scratch myself.
Mm-hmm.
One, basically, we were taking raw land, dividing it to acres, and selling them as home sites, partially in Texas, mostly in North Carolina at that time. And I was always sensitive about trees and things of that nature. So whenever you bought any property from me at that time, you couldn't clear the woods 10 or 15 feet, you know, from the home site. So I was sensitive to the environment in that respect, which plays a lot into what's going on today with this ET thing. But prior, and also as far as abductions and being pulled, no, that stuff didn't exist. And I took a common sense approach about UFOs. I figured, gee, you know, the cosmos is so huge. Literally, there's billions of stars. There's a 10 times that many planets, perhaps, compared to stars, and maybe something intelligent would buzz by from time to time with photographs and videos of these things, but certainly not the occupants and having an agenda, as I later learned, and it's quite an agenda. And mid-'88, things changed from out of nowhere, out of the blue, and like you said, it was all totally conscious. They never took the physical memory away from me from day one, and we're working on almost between 19 and 20 years now.
And that's rare.
And that's real.
Based on what we've heard, yeah.
And Jim, can you explain what was the very first hard physical evidence that convinced you, my God, I am really physically going somewhere?
Sure. Around mid-'88, I started having what I thought, and this is how they started. A lot of the things we'll be talking about in the show, I'll be sharing with everybody tonight. It's going to sound a little scary, but as we get into it, there's good reason why some of the things that they do are done that way, and I'll get into a little more of that. But anyway, in the beginning, for me, it was like it was a dream, and it was a reoccurring dream. But it was the same dream I kept having, and I was having it 2 to 3 times a week for several weeks in a row. Sometimes a week would go by, and I would not have that same dream, and then it led into months of the same dream. And it went, I was in my bed, something or some things were coming into the bedroom, and they were escorting me out of the bedroom, down the hallway, into the guest room. And there's a reason I'm going to go into a little detail about the guest room. In our guest room was approximate floor-level window. And we would walk through this window into the woods, which I had no memory of what went on in the woods. And they would escort me back the same way, through this window, back down the hallway, and put me back into the bed. And as far as I was concerned, it was just a disturbing dream that I kept having over and over again. After a couple of months of that, or several weeks of it, into a couple of months of it, I became conscious, like we're talking on the phone now, you know, hard reality conscious during this, quote-unquote, what I thought was a reoccurring dream. I felt myself up, standing in the bedroom after they got me out of the bed. I was walking down the hall. I could feel the carpet on my feet. When we got into the guest room and we started, as it was in that dream, but now here it is in reality, I'm wide awake, we started walking to the window, and I thought my heart was going to stop because I'm thinking, oh, my God, you can't really be walking me through a window. in which they did. We were in the lawn, and then we went into the woods that were across the street. And again, the memory at that point was taken away, and I was escorted back the same way. Now, what made this particular evening that changed everything was the fact that our lawn had these what I call honeysuckle bushes, and they yielded thousands and thousands of these little tiny flowers. Everybody probably remembers those things. I say honeysuckle. They may not be the exact name for the species of plant, but you can suck the nectar out of it as a kid, and it would be sweet. And they would stick to your feet, George and Linda. So that was a normal thing. So that morning when I was returned and woke up, because I passed out after they put me back, and then I woke up, I walked into the guest room, and then I was rather shocked by what I saw. Outside in the lawn, I could see, because of the dew and everything, your footprints, when they show real well in the lawn early in the morning like that, you could see my footprints embedded in the lawn with the honeysuckle flowers pushed into the grass, and at the window, the heel of one foot was in the lawn with the honeysuckle flowers, and the toes and the ball of my feet were on the carpet, and the flowers of the petals were embedded into the carpet. And then you could see my other footprints as I was going forward with the grass and honeysuckle flowers in them. And then I could also see tiny little footprints to my right and to my left. In those early months, they took away almost all peripheral vision. So in those early months, I didn't see what my captors were. But, of course, I'll get into that in a little bit. But
there was a reason, Jim, why they didn't want you to really see them and hone in on them?
Absolutely. I mean, what I've learned throughout the years is one particular agenda is the fact that there is a global program where they have abducted millions of people, and people have been enhanced with what to do about environmental issues. Amnesty, and I'll go into detail in that a little bit later in the show for sure. However, the main reason, George, for taking the physical memory away is because you'll get in your own way, meaning that if you have a two-hour experience with otherworldly beings, now in my case, better than 95% of the time, I've been interacting with beings that are commonly referred to as grays, and a particular species of grays. And if you remember the trauma of being with them, because they're so different in that two-hour period or three-hour period, whatever the abduction may be, there's no way that you could function normally during the day. Or in your life, I should say.
Well, yeah, you may never be the same again.
You can't be. You can't be. And so I'm one of the few, for various reasons, some unknown, some I'm certain about over the years I've learned, that I always thought it was the curse of the physical memory not taken away, but as the years have gone by, I'm very happy to know that I have been granted that pleasure or privilege, because I can share these things with people. And but the fact that there was the physical evidence was the footprints were in the carpet and stuff like that, it just floored me. My life, as Linda said, changed right at that moment, because I knew something abnormal, paranormal was going on. I vacuumed up the leaves and everything, and I vacuumed up the little petals. I vacuumed up all the stuff, and I said, well, the next night I'm going to make sure it's perfectly clean, or the next time this happens, will that be there? Well, for several weeks afterwards, it was the same story. I'd go back into that room, and sure as heck, it would be the same thing.
And, Jim, it was almost as if this other intelligence wanted you to realize this was physical.
Yes, it was, and I do know that today because, let's face what we're dealing with here. I can tell you, for starters, particularly when we talk about the grays, we're talking about beings that think 10 to 100 times faster. We're talking about beings that are 100% telepathic. I've never seen or heard a ET or a non-human intelligent gray speak. They have the mental ability to screen image things in your mind and create any reality they want, and you believe it's happening. Now, in most cases, I've learned that the screen imaging is done to take the path of least resistance. So if you're one that's, say you're a person that enjoys the study of angelic beings or peaceful beings, then you're going to feel like that's what you're with or that's what you're going to see. If you're one that controls you during the abduction scenario, if you're a person that's afraid of, let's say, devils or demonic things and things like that scare you, and then sometimes they'll create that type of reality to scare you into cooperating, like some harm will come to you if you don't. And those are strong things, and not to mention that their technology is 100% thought-activated. We're talking about beings, and this is all science, and this is how I stayed anchored to maintain my sanity, and there were times I came pretty close to losing it, as you can imagine.
And Linda, let me ask Linda this quick question, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that the ETs that Jim, the Greys, that Jim had experience with were the same type of race with the Barney and Betty Hill case?
I would say no. Okay, now I...
Jim, let me just jump in here for just a second. It is such a good question, and the only thing that I wanted to put in here right now is that the EBENs, the extraterrestrial biological entities that the government has written about in its documents, tend to be pear-headed, not have the big black slanted eyes, and don't have the severe pointed chin. And there is a great deal of confusion between the EBENs, who seem to be extremely advanced and may be what Jim and Betty were dealing with, versus the Greys, which seem to be a bit more strict, rigid, and you might even say hostile. Now, with that being my only lob here to George's question, Jim, go ahead and talk about this difference that you and I have talked about between the EBENs and the Greys and what your perspective is.
Well, see, I've learned throughout the years, because none of this came easy. That's why in the program I'm going to break it down in three parts, the first 6-7 years, years 8 through, say, 13, and years 14 upwards close to 19 or 20. And each period evolved into learning. And those first 6-7 years were traumatic, horror-filled, changed my life, messed up my business, messed up my marriage, because it was all in my face, between the emotional experiments, between the semen extraction, between all the things that, like I say, are going to sound scary that I later learned why. You're talking about things that were very traumatic in those early years, particularly in those first 18 months. But, however, to answer your question, what I've learned about this particular species of Greys is they live an extremely long, long, long time, if they even pass away at all, an endless lifespan.
Well, Jim, are they biological or machine?
There's both, okay, and that's a good question, George. You have what I believe most abductees deal with are the 3-foot-tall. These are half-biological beings. I'm going to talk about two types in this group that have been dealing with me for all these years. There's the worker beings. These are half-biological and half-robotic, clearly. They're both. They are beings that are created or produced, manufactured. They are programmed to perform tasks. Throughout the years, I used to, I did everything I could in my power in those early years to mess up any agenda or any plan they had in abduction. Anything I can do to mess them up, that's what my whole life was about in those early years, because I didn't want anything to do with it. When it came to those little worker beings, they had the big heads, the giant teardrop eyes, the skinny necks, and they all looked alike. What I used to try to prod out of them in those early years and would pride myself from time to time when I would get this kind of reaction was some kind of a either emotional response, or I would try very hard to get a self-awareness response. Because
let's pick it up right with there, Jim, when we come right back. Jim Sparks with us. Linda Moulton-Howe stays this hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We've got Linda Moulton-Howe this hour, earthfiles.com, and, of course, Jim Sparks for the entire program. And, Linda, this is an incredible discussion with Jim with regards to the biological machine-type entity, isn't it?
Well, the android issue has been there going back at least 30 years. there was a military guy who was apparently involved in an autopsy on entities that were retrieved from a crash. And he described in that particular instance that he was stunned to realize that they were not dealing with something that was purely organic, because what we would say would be the skin of an entity, it was actually like suede. It was like a cloth when they cut into it. And this issue of a more advanced intelligence that can make these worker bees that can do all kinds of programmed assignments has been part of the human abduction syndrome. And this comes to the issue of EBENs, extraterrestrial biological entities, simply being a phrase that our government has used that has been applied to the pear-shaped, five-foot, large eyes or larger, but not the severe black angled eyes. And Jim was making a very good distinction about the small androids that I think most of us have come to accept, that we're dealing, for the most part, when you come to human interaction with the non-human intelligence, it is usually with the programmed androids. But there are the intelligences behind the androids. And this is what Jim has had firsthand conscious experience with, what he calls the real, true aliens. And Jim, I wonder if you could go into the power, the energy that you have felt off of those. And something that I still feel is one of the most fascinating technology discussions that I've ever had, and that is your seeing the demonstration of them being able to extend themselves in only percentages.
Sure. And capping off or finishing off the worker beings, I believe that, as you said, Linda, that most abductees deal with that. And their creators are about anywhere from a foot to a foot and a half, 4 feet or more, instead of being 3 feet, close to 5 feet, in some cases taller. Now, all those little worker beings look the same. As far as what, as you mentioned, and as I said, the what I call the true aliens or the true grays in that particular species, they are taller. Their heads are bigger than ours or bigger than normal, but they're not extra large as the little beings. Their eyes are bigger than ours, but not nearly as big as those huge teardrop eyes as the worker beings, which I've surmised those huge teardrop eyes in a lot of cases. I'm believing that it absorbs energy, and that's how it works or operates to power itself, either it be any kind of stimuli, be it light, be it movement. But with that being said, back to the grays, their skin is leather-like. Their mouths are thin. Their chins are pointy, but not quite as pointy as the little worker beings. But their skin is leather-like in texture. But you can see different patches of wrinkles. But it's not so obvious at first. It took many months into years, and for me to start to easily, after a while, distinguish the difference from one individual to the other. So they are, and you can distinguish the difference, and they are biological. They are alive.
And they don't wear uniforms, Jim?
No. No. They almost look as if they're naked.
Yeah. Okay.
For George, for the best way I can describe it, as far as genitals are concerned, you don't see any genitals, either male nor female. There's nothing there to – but one gets, and I have throughout all the years, to the sex aspect of it, gets the impression that the bulk of them that work with people are male, and on occasion I've come across the feminine, and there's no doubt it was the feminine by the way she looked, and I say she, and of course the way she behaved. These beings appear to have no emotions, but however, over time I've learned that they do have emotions, but it's a different form of emotions, and it's long-term thinking emotions. So they don't respond emotionally every few seconds as we do as human beings. So their emotions are long, long, long-term. There seems to be a sense of humor. I've seen that from time to time. It's rather cynical. These are beings that do not like to answer questions. They do not respond to questions, and if they do, they usually answer ambiguously or they answer in riddles.
Hmm.
Primarily, George, because when you think about it, if you've been working with human beings for thousands of years, and abducting them on a nightly basis, on a global basis, by the millions. It's typical. Who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here? Da 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 da. And so they've just they're callous and cold when it comes to that. But in my case, over the years, there were reward and punishment sessions for cooperating. Punishment, which I'll get into a little bit earlier, which evolved into some pretty cool stuff. And the reward sessions were where I was allowed to ask questions and get answers. But back to what Linda was saying. They don't go by name, at least the ones I've ever worked with in the last 19 years or more. They radiate energy, and whatever that level of energy is dictates rank or dictates whether you're a superior or whether you're you have a higher management role. And I'm talking in particularly the Greys themselves, the true aliens. For example, a couple of them can be in the room, and they radiate an energy that's always miserably uncomfortable. It's either a natural defense mechanism, or it's enhanced technology, technically. But I've also surmised over the years that this energy feels queer, feels scary, feels weird, paralyzes you in a lot of cases, due to the fact that literally it's an otherworldly energy. It's something not from this dimension and not from this planet, and the body just reacts to it not very well. But over time, human beings are resilient. We become conditioned to it, and I've learned to be around these guys, and it doesn't bother me anymore. But the first few seconds, it does. But, however, interestingly enough, if two are in the room and they're working on a situation, when I say room, on board a craft with people, and let's say something's getting out of hand or something's out of their control or they're trying to get an experiment finished and it's just not working, you can feel the presence coming from outside the room of a superior or a higher-ranking gray, and that energy is more overwhelming. Your spine will straighten up. You'll have shortness of breath. Your heartbeat becomes very rapid. When they come into the room and get closer to you, then you become paralyzed or totally paralyzed, and it's a sensation of complete fear of being overcome. They can lean over you and say, don't do that. Cooperate with this. And it's so overwhelmingly strong that you will do it. And after they leave, you get a sense of relief, and then you still feel the energy of the lower level in the supervisory role of the other beings that are there. From time to time, we would get appearances over the years to see how these experiments were going on from very, very, what I would say, high-ranking individuals, probably at what we would call in a general range, as a general, that type of rank.
And were they all experiments, Jim, or were there also teaching programs?
Definitely was teaching. But, George, the first 6 years, I was not a cooperator, and particularly the first 18 months. I did everything in my power to disrupt anything possible there. I contribute a lot of my hate, loathing, focused anger on one of the main reasons why I maintained such an excellent conscious memory of everything that went on. I was able over time to shake off the screen imaging, meaning that where they would create a reality that wasn't such or lead you to believe it. But all of this was a learning process. But, of course, they don't have any social skills, and little social skills. I was talking about earlier that this was gentle when they used to escort me from my bedroom and to on board through the window. Abruptly, in latter 88, out of nowhere, I got pulled what I call the hard way. The first way I'm describing to get you from point A to point B is the easy way, George, and the second way is the hard way. Now, the hard way is here's where a lot of the technology comes into play, where you can see it. The hard way was I was laying in the bed. There was a loud whirling, whipping sound and low RPMs inside my head. It got louder and louder and louder. There was a sensation in the pit of my stomach that worked its way to my upper torso, When it got there, my heart started racing at a million miles an hour, it seemed like it. And then the sound got extremely loud, and then there was this absolute sensation of acceleration. Only you were going down, and now you're blacked out, you're conscious, but you can't, you're paralyzed, and you feel like you're going down a roller coaster only 100 times faster. I'm getting into the learning thing with this, believe it or not. And you black out completely, be it G-forces, be whatever it is. When I regained consciousness the first time, and this is the way it was for me throughout the whole 6 years, I was in this room. I had no clue where I was. I was sitting on a bench. I was almost totally paralyzed, but going, well, 99%. In front of me was a table, and I called it a screen table. What that turned out to be was a teaching machine. It was complete artificial intelligence. In front of that table was a screen on the wall, on a wall, about 5 to 8 feet, I should say, in front of that table. That's where I found myself for year after year after year, week after week, month after month, hundreds and hundreds of times, even within those first 6 years.
And were you up in a craft, Jim, or were you in a craft on land somewhere?
No doubt on board, no doubt out there, and
in space somewhere.
Deep space, I would say, definitely,
okay.
Because they can go from point A to point B, George, with no time passing. The technology is phenomenal.
Yeah, next hour we'll talk about that propulsion system. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, here I was the very first evening, not knowing who my captors were, and this is, I was paralyzed except for my right hand was leaning on this table. And I could move my right forefinger, and I would move it in any direction. It would be like an exosketch, like when we were kids. It would make a mark on the table. It would make a mark on the wall. I still don't know what's going on. And they didn't say, hi, would you like to learn about what you may be involved in 18 years from now? Would you like to go through these experiments? Would you like to learn this? None of that stuff. The very first thing, telepathic command that came out of them at first was, well, before it came out, the block letter A, our block letter A, came up on this screen, and then this symbol that was equivalent, or what I thought was an alien alphabet at the time, but I've later learned it's phenomenal, which we can get into, came next to it, and what they said to do was to sketch the equivalent of the block letter A as in that symbol. And that was it. And not knowing where I was there, why I was there, all this junk was happening earlier with the going through the window and everything. The next thing I know, I go through this gut-wrenching way of being transported, which I later learned that when a craft is in flight and they use the technology to pull you or hovering, that's the kind they use, which is gut-wrenching. The other, when they're on the ground, then they escort you, was the other way. And so, of course, I didn't want to do anything like that, and I did have my vocal ability, and I just screamed out, no, 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 and yelled and screamed, and who are you, and every cuss word under the sun, and why am I here? I didn't even know they were aliens at that time.
Were you the only human there at the time, Jim?
Absolutely.
Or were there others? You were the one. Okay.
Yeah. Later on in the years, I've all this built up to around the sixth, seventh year where I was actually walking around free. I was able to participate in mass abductions around the globe where they picked up hundreds up to 1,000 people at the same time, and that's something we can talk about, where I had freedom, but I knew how to behave. But in those first 6 years, all I wanted to do was kill them. And on a lighter side, I used to yell out, if I was not paralyzed, I would squeeze your fat heads off your skinny little neck.
I take it they don't have a sense of humor, Jim.
They really don't, but over the years I learned that they have a cynical one, and I'll get into that as this conversation progresses, what led to it, because there were some humorous moments, and I really lightened up after the first six years. I lightened up a lot because the stuff that I was learning and the experiments that they were doing that I had no clue where they were going to go, and started going places with it, were phenomenal. And that's why the title, as you mentioned early in the show, that I went from resistor to cooperator. But it wasn't something that just happened overnight. And as Linda mentioned, I didn't want anything. I had no clue things like this had existed, and I didn't want anything to do with it.
Did they break you down, Jim? Is that what finally happened?
That's what one would say. But my take was, I saw that it was that because I named it an alien boot camp those first 18 months to 6 years. In particular, and I was resistant to that. So anything that was thrown at me, I did anything I could to throw a curve under the conditions of being mostly paralyzed. The way they got me to do, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
The way they got me to do the letters at first was when the A came up on the board, and of course I wasn't going to sketch their stupid symbol. That's what I called it at that time, and every cuss word under the sun. The air pressure in the room would abruptly increase like a thump, thump, and it would hurt my ears. And I'd scream out, no, because I figured out, okay, no, you ain't going to get me to do a thing. And then they would increase the levels one level at a time until the pain was just intolerable, and I would sketch a few marks of that symbol, and boom, I would get to go back home. These sessions were based on if I cooperated, there was if I cooperated, there was no pain, and if I did cooperate, didn't, there was pain. But that's where I break it down in three parts. In those first 6 years, the sessions of reward and punishment started to become evolved, and they started becoming fantastic. Where
and what do you mean by punishment? Because earlier you said it seemed like you liked it.
I hated it.
Right.
The punishment aspect of it, George. In other words, even when I say punishment, the fact that I would not cooperate in these experiments, the air pressure in the room would increase, which would cause pain. That's what I mean by punishment.
Okay. Let's get Linda in, because, Linda, we're going to lose you soon.
Right.
And we've got – go ahead.
I'm fascinated listening to Jim, and one of the areas that he and I have talked about so much that I think is one of the most interesting and maybe an answer to some ghost sightings.
Oh, yeah.
And that is that we're dealing with intelligences that might have its home base in a parallel universe, and that they are actually being able to use technology to project themselves here, and that the main powerful ones don't have to be here physically in this universe at all times, but that they can literally project percentages of themselves. And Jim, could you explain that and how that might relate to the translucence of some ghost images?
Sure, and I think that's why you gravitated so much to the documentary, The Visitor Phenomena, that was made.
Right.
We put that together along with the book, by the way. I should tell your audience this on the website, which is, because it's more graphic details, jim-sparks.com or jim-sparks.com, whichever you prefer. And we did a special price for your audience, George. But to answer the question, they have a technology that literally there are other dimensions. They occupy the same space and they occupy the same time. They can be 95% in another dimension and 95% of their working essence, I should say, in another dimension, and 5% of their essence in this dimension, where at anywhere from 1 to 5%, they would be invisible. If they are at 10% in this dimension to 30% or 40%, only it's because you can start seeing through them. You can look right through them as if they were a ghost or as if they were a spirit, and they take on more solid form through technology to move physical objects in our dimension.
Stay with us, Jim. Linda, I want to thank you for spending the hour with us.
It's been
a pleasure. You helped jumpstart this.
Yeah. Take care, you guys. God bless, Jim.
And we'll talk to you in your October report shortly, Linda. We'll be back with Jim Sparks in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, let's get into now the three major stages of this evolution that occurred with you. We've skimmed on some of it. But then the first phase, let's get into that.
Sure. Basically, as mentioned, the easier way to see the picture is I break it down in three parts over the last 20 years, and we got into the pretty much what it was like in those first 6-7 years, which seemed, George, there was no rhyme and reason. It completely disrupted my life. I, if it wasn't for the fact that I had a partnership with that second business, and my partner pretty much took over, and some money saved away, I wouldn't have made it through those first 6 years.
And how often was this happening to you, Jim?
It was just phenomenally often. It was just mind-boggling often. It would happen 2-3 times a week, sometimes 4 times a week, for several weeks in a row, week after week, after month.
And even though in your dreams you remembered this a couple times a week, do you think it might have been occurring then more? You just didn't remember it?
It could have, because as I mentioned earlier in the show, that the physical memory is taken away from people because, almost by your words, that we would tend to get in our own way, particularly when there's a message involved. Well, this stuff did evolve into something pretty spectacular, but to appreciate it, and the way I break it down is that it was in that punishment and reward era. So, but the punishment and reward started becoming evolving into being ignored in the second set of 7 years for punishment, and the reward would be explained knowledge and agenda. In the last 6-7 years, the punishment didn't no longer exist because the interaction has evolved to the point of where now there's a global agenda, and it's almost at the point of critical mass. But to get there, the steps that one went through, and particularly in my case, as I mentioned earlier, I was force learned to convert, having no clue, convert block letters into these symbols. Now, not only did it was it just A, but it was B, it was C, and it went on and it went on with no Q's or Z's. Then that's several months of that. Now, during the course of all of this, again, this stuff's going to sound scary, but it evolved. There was an almost any session where they wouldn't extract semen. There was almost no sessions where they would do emotional experiments to get your reaction to it. And it always was, again, on that same level of being forced to learn these letters. But what was happening to me was I was seeing a picture of, you know, Jim, the more you resist, the longer you stay here, the more you cooperate, then you get to leave sooner. As far as my reality went in my normal life, I dropped 35, 40 pounds, and I'm not a big person. At that time, I was around 170 pounds.
No, that's too much. It's called the ET diet, Jim, and it's not a good one, huh?
No, unless you really wanted to lose that weight, it'd be great, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, during the course of that, my hygiene went to pot. My hair grew out. I didn't shave. I wasn't bathing. I would try to get away, meaning that I would get in my car and I'd drive into the downtown of a major city and I'd check out a hotel room. Again, luckily, I had a buffer of money at that time, and I would be in the middle of a hotel room surrounded by all these other rooms and floors thinking they couldn't get me. They'd abduct me. I'd drive from state to state. And it even got to the point where I even abandoned my home. At that time, it was in Texas, and moved down to Florida. But I woke up one day, and I looked at myself in the mirror and said, you know something, Jim? There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do to stop them. It's going to happen. Wherever this thing is going to go. And I immediately changed. I started eating again, and I, you know, got myself together.
You stopped fighting it.
I stopped fighting it. As a matter of fact, you couldn't have worded it better. But now the reward sessions, when I started having that attitude in the fourth, fifth, and sixth years, started becoming fascinating. I started accepting the rewards instead of resisting them because I used to consider myself, oh, I'm this laboratory mouse, I'm this laboratory rat, and I'm not going to cooperate with you. I'm going to bite you whenever I can.
Yeah.
But however, as I started to cooperate, the rewards were I started learning. For example, first they always offered euphoria. They bathed you in extreme euphoria like you've never felt. And it's akin to like a sexual energy that you're bathed in when you cooperate. And it's something that we're all adults here. We all know what a climactic feeling is. And you could maintain that climactic feeling for minutes into 10 minutes and the 15 minutes and the 20 minutes. Something like that is pretty hard to resist. I was resistant to it at first, but over time I let them dabble with me when I cooperated. Then the reward sessions would go into getting to, if I cooperated again and I did well and I was learning fast, then I got to tinker with gizmos. What I mean by gizmos was, as I mentioned earlier, all their technology is thought activated. So there's an interaction evolving here into a trust form. Now, still I maintained being paralyzed. They still didn't let me go. And I went to a lot of graphic detail when I wrote the book And I wrote the book as if it was happening to you, and what would you do? So here's this normal guy, and what would you do? And this is what I did. And that, and I methodically wrote it that way so one can get a real, real picture and a feel for what it's like to interact with these beings. Now, some of the reward sessions with the gizmos were pretty cool. For example, you could move objects with your mind. And none of that even came easy. It was an exercise. There was a, they put a something like a marble on the table and telepathically told to think about rolling the marble in whatever direction you want it to go, and that's what it'll do.
Can you do that now without them?
Personally, no, not without it being aided by them.
Okay.
There is a residual energy that tends to stick with you. If you're in alien technology many times, for a long extended periods of time, you've probably heard abductees say that when they get angry or emotional, sometimes things will fly off the table and or something will move. And on occasion, things like that would happen. And I always took a scientific approach, but I could never really control it. But on times when I was worked up, things might fly or move, but I could never really control it. Well, I rolled that ball. The next thing they put on the table was a cube, George. Like a bigger, three times the size of a sugar cube, and it says that, all right, flip the cube over from end to end. Now I had to focus a lot harder. I knew I was being aided by them, and the thing would flip over. And then the third object was a something akin to a triangle, but it looked like a pyramid. And then I was told to flip it from end to end, which was took a lot more concentration. So it was the little weak thoughts in my mind that were picked up by their technology that activated the machine that would make this stuff happen. But they were very, very cautious with this stuff. They made sure they were always around. They were always on top of me. And so now these reward sessions started to evolve into something that had practical meaning and deeper meaning and understanding. But it was a slow process. I still wasn't seeing the picture. But what started changing things, and I'm still in that first third, was the fact that on one particular session, they presented 50 pages of text in normal English block lettering, and it was a story about a friend of mine. His name was Jerry. From birth, where he was born, so on and so forth, page after page. And I'm thinking, why are they having me read this? It meant nothing to me, George. And it got to the point where he was an adult, and then it went into the future. Now, that started getting my attention. And so when the 50 pages of text were done, they then presented that symbolic form that I was converting the block letters into their letters on a half a page, and I could read the whole thing. So that was a phenomenal turning point. I went, my God, I can read 50 pages of text, and I can understand the whole thing in a half a page or less than a half a page. Then they put it in something the size of a 50-cent piece symbol, and where you would look at the symbol in a flash, and you'd get the whole 50 pages. They could take that symbol and present it in front of your face, and here it was, the abbreviated form of the symbols that I was learning. I later learned that this was also a elementary form of teaching a human being telepathic communication. And what do I mean by that? George, when you have a thought, or when I have a thought, or if we a thought could be a sentence in our mind, our brain waves are jumping up and down, and they're scattered throughout our mind.
Sure, there, yeah.
And not in necessarily in order. So if I were to say, hi, George, how are you today? And you were to say, hi, Jim, how are you today? If we got a reading on it, it would be scattered in all different orders. Nothing would be the same. But what I learned was that by taking these block letters and putting them into a symbolic form, you're focusing or concentrating the energy unbeknownst to you in this learning process in a simple, strong energy form, meaning that let's say the letter A was simply a line from the right to the left to the right. You had to draw over the line three times, one, two, three. Now, if I'm focusing that one, two, three in my mind, any sensitive receiver won't pick up as many scattered brain waves, you know, all over the place. It'll start picking up a pattern. And then, of course, it's computerized into that means the letter A, and someone that has a receiver on the receiving end, it picks up that, and then it translates it to the letter A in that other mind. Even my body sometimes would vibrate back and forth to it. Over time, I began to realize they wanted me to use the symbolic form versus just plain telepathic form to communicate with them. Now here we go with the reward sessions. Now they're getting better. If I would ask a question and I wanted a question answered, then I would have to do it in my mind in that symbolic form that I learned, and then they would respond telepathically in kind. So it got to the point where they can download or upload, I should say, into a human being, massive amount of data, massive amount of information in a real short period of time, because we're capable of that. We just don't have the sequence as a rule.
Did you have to be the receptor, or could they just send it into you at will?
There was a couple of ways. Fascinatingly enough, as the receptor and consciously aware of it, you can sense all of that information like a vibration going. But I know that sometimes even my finger on that table would move profusely in exact order to the sentences and letters of all those symbols put together. So even as my right forefinger was on that teaching machine, it would vibrate and move to that data, and I would understand it. As the years have progressed, I know that I can have interaction in a very short, brief period of time, and then they can upload a ton of information into me without me being consciously aware of what the information is, but later it unwinds sort of like a reel-to-reel tape, and then the data slowly unwinds where my mind can comprehend it, but it's a long story, or it's long or large amounts of information. That's what started to happen in those first 6 years. Now, again, I was paralyzed. I wasn't allowed to be let loose, but the reward sessions became pleasant, and the reward sessions started to have some meat to it or understanding, still not knowing what these guys were doing, still not knowing what these guys were up to. When it came to the semen extraction, instead of me fighting them and warring with them, I just let them do it, and I got to go home quicker. But then, as I said, cool things started to happen.
Did you ever feel threatened at this point?
When one is around this energy that they radiate, which is miserably uncomfortable, or you do feel the sensation of that it could kill you. But what I've learned, and this is what I tell people, George, is that you're not going to die from this stuff. It's extremely intimidating, but you're not going to die. What you're learning through this process is what it's like to be around these otherworldly beings face-to-face, up close and personal, and the average person being thrown in that situation isn't going to be able to handle it. So there's a lot of things I can share, because as I mentioned earlier, they're telepathic, they screen image, the technology is thought activated. These guys travel dimensions. They can go from point A to point B anywhere in the universe with no time passing. And they're light years ahead as to what you may think they are technically. It's phenomenal what they do.
Do they bend space and time for traveling?
I can tell you this, that if they had to go from here, point A being this solar system, to point B at the outer reaches of the galaxy, you're just there within seconds. But when it comes, but there is something interesting. I don't know if it's a bend, but what I do know, that there's another type of travel is where they use other dimensions, meaning that they create a field. They do this a lot, George. It's some kind of a field. There's a distortion in the field. And matter, as the laws of physics, as we understand it, no longer apply. Matter behaves in a different way. That's why they've been seen walking through walls. So these guys, for example, when they go from one dimension to the other, you can be, again, at a very distant point by simply, literally, walking through. Now, what are they doing in that walk-through process? They're creating this field. You can see it. It's a distortion in the air. You're in it. It alters your matter. It alters the matter around you. You literally walk, and you're walking through walls, and you're at different places at different times. Now, what I found fascinating during those periods, which were not as common as the point A to point B and blacking out and you're there, was the fact that I could see different entities and different things that lived and existed in these other dimensions. There was never interaction between them and whatever these entities were, but they were there as we passed through. So they
Did you ever see reptilians or the praying mantis type beings?
Right around the seventh year, when I had my first interaction with what are commonly referred to as reptilians, because I had scales.
Scales and scares.
Yeah, man. And actually, there's over the years I've interacted, or they've interacted with me. It's not like I had a choice with three or four different species. Well, four different species of what are commonly referred to as reptilians. And I can see why a lot of people think there's abductees that think they're bad because there is a species that's not quite nice. Mm-hmm. And then there's others that are just phenomenally human in almost every way, shape, or form, but they're just so extremely highly intelligent with a lot of information to share. But see, this is a process. And now, towards the end of the first 6 years, things started to change again, and it started moving forward, unbeknownst to me. I always said all I ever wanted to do was kill them.
And they knew that. Even if you were thinking it, they knew that.
They
right?
knew it, George. They knew that if I was bent set on killing them or tearing up the ship, and I was always paralyzed, and I screamed it out. I made up cuss words for those guys. You let me loose, I'll kill you. I'll kill you. I'll kill you. I'll kill you. And so even as things started to progress, as far as the reward sessions are concerned, I didn't so much verbalize it as I still had that animosity in me. It's like you came into my life out of nowhere. I didn't want anything to do with this, and I'm still part of this process, and I feel like I don't have a choice. Now, interesting things started to take place. I had been pulled. When I got to my room, it's same stinking room, and then, by the way, I've mentioned how the air is circulated in that place. When you're in the room, the air is fresh, and it can go 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, and it gets hot, moist, hot, humid, and hard to breathe, and then all of a sudden there'll be a blast of cool, fresh air. So intermittently, it wasn't like being on a jet airliner. The way they did the rooms or the atmosphere on board was you suffered through some stale air and relieved by a blast of fresh air. Hmm. So unfortunately, it wasn't a continuous basis. So
was that for them or you?
For me, for human. Right. So unfortunately, a lot of times you were sitting there sweating, dirty, oily, and uncomfortable. So even just being in that with all this tenseness and pressure and otherworldly things around you, it was quite intense and quite uncomfortable. But an interesting scenario took place. I had gotten pulled. When I got there, I blacked out. I came to quickly, and I found myself on a gurney, and I could smell my saliva or your – I don't mean to sound gross, but if you were – your saliva doesn't smell good if you were to spit, okay, like a normal thing, or somebody were to do that to you as a child or whatever. But it was – what was coming was a vapor was coming out of my lungs.
All right, hold the thought, Jim. Hold the thought. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Jim, at any point, did they tell you if they seeded us in the beginning?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. Throughout the, particularly in those first 6 years, I used to yell at them, you know, why me, why me, why me? And they answered the question in a way that answers your question. I had been in a session that was quite tenuous, rather remote, extreme emotional experiments, and I did well. So when it was time for the reward session, I was adamant about why are you doing this or why me? And they answered this way. First, equivalent to a hologram appeared, and it was a World War II scene with Nazi Germans and Italian Axis power soldiers. Two officers were making war plans in a war-torn village guarded by Nazi soldiers. And as I looked into their faces, I could see a family resemblance. So I picked up right away, George, that was some kind of tracking of my family line at that point.
Right.
The next scene that appeared was around the late 1800s, turn of the century, and it was a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a factory. What country it was in, I'm not sure, but I guessed it mostly be the United States. Men were in top hats cutting the ribbons. One of the faces looked like one of my family members. See, it's odd how they answer questions. It progressed back to around 1300 to a medieval village, fishing village, and I could see myself in the field or something that looked like me. Not reincarnation, just family with crude farming instruments, farming some vegetables. it kept going further back. It got into the Roman period, and all these things are true because my lineage and heritage is of that time and period. My family
exactly.
Went back to Rome
sure.
2,000 years ago, and I could see myself or something similar to myself or a family resemblance sitting at the bleachers while there was a debate going on in the early democracy, you could say. Okay, then it jumped radically to what looked like, and this made me angry, by the way, and you'll hear what I said. It looked like, George, the savanna, African savanna plains. There were these creatures in these plains that were ape-like in appearance, but they weren't chimpanzee or looking apes, and they weren't human-looking, but they were a cross, something I had never seen before. They were
like maybe what Bigfoot could look like?
Smaller, though. Now,
okay.
Bigfoot is something that, Bigfoot is like a worker bean that they use to haul stuff around. When they come here, they they do control they have the power to control the mines, and they use whatever is available for labor, and I'm certain that that's one of the beasts that they use literally to help them mine or whatever laborious tasks that there are that the little beans can't do.
And they leave it here.
Yes, but I think Bigfoot has been here. What I believe is that they use Bigfoot for these things throughout the globe because Bigfoot is everywhere. But these things didn't look like Bigfoot. They were agile like we were, but they were ape-like in their appearance. And now, during the course of all that, George, there wasn't any telepathic messages. They were just letting me see scene after scene. But when they got to that last one, they clearly said, "We manipulated these beings to make you what you are today as a human being."
Uh-huh.
Genetically, and that was the word. Now, I was angry about it because I didn't want to accept that as being so. I didn't want them to think that they were my keepers, so to speak. And it screamed, "That's a bunch of lies, and I don't believe it, yaddy-daddy-daddy." Well, I now know. There was another scene that had come up, which I thought was extremely fascinating, and I've never publicly talked about this one, so you get to be the first on this.
Here we go. All right.
There was another part of the globe where many, many, many tens of thousands of years ago, hundreds of thousands of years ago, they came in mass, like a dozen ships. They were there to mine. They came, hovered over the planet. They literally exploded the area that they were going to work in to kill anything that was around it to create a perimeter for safety. And in those beams that were coming down and things that were exploding over the earth, and you can see this in hologram form, it just took my breath away. I intend to write about this in more detail, too. I'm writing another book. But anyway, after the area was cleared and safe and they landed, they built a perimeter around it, almost like a wire. Okay, now picture this one. They're in this thing that's like a camp. And then sneaking in through the woods come these ape-like creatures
mm-hmm.
that looked like the earlier ones that were curious. Now, fascinatingly enough, one of them had a weapon and was about to blow away one that was peering almost over that perimeter that they had put there. But there was one fascinating aspect of it, and the other one grabbed his arm and stopped him from shooting it or killing it because it had a smile on its face. And I'll never forget that hologram of these ape-like looking creatures behind it that didn't express any sort of emotion, but this one was childlike in its nature. He was leaning forward towards the perimeter, and you could see a smile, like almost like a baby or a child. It was curious. And the
like
other one,
maybe the genetic altering had been underway.
It could have been.
Yeah.
It could have been. Now, I know they used us in those early years as what the worker beings are now through these things that I've seen. And I like your take on it there because it did express an emotion on its face.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, now things are evolving here a little bit, even though I'm resistant, George, other things started happening. As I mentioned, I was on this gurney. There was this vapor coming out of my lungs. I had no clue what it was. But an extraordinary thing happened. I woke up during a procedure. When I came to, I was back in that room, where the table and the bench and all that stuff I was mentioning to you earlier was. And this time I was standing up, and I was leaning against the table. I had gotten pulled. I was leaning against it, and I had physical mobility. Now, that was the first time in years that I had ever was able to stand up. I'm by myself in this room, and I'm looking around, and I'm looking at this place where light emanates from everywhere, but yet nowhere specifically, where that stinking bench was, that stupid teaching machine, still called it all that kind of stuff. Here's the screen, and I'm moving around, and two of them come into the room holding a black box, about the size of a shoebox, only perfectly square. It wasn't rectangular. Absorbent black box. And they came walking up. I looked at their eyes. I looked down on the floor. I looked at their eyes. I looked down at the floor. I didn't want to look at their eyes. They walk over to the table. They put the box on the table. Now, I'm astounded that I can move around, and now I have the freedom, if I wanted to lunge forward and beat the crap out of these guys.
If you wanted to, or to take the box, or do anything you wanted.
I wanted to do, but it was in me like, I know how to behave. Don't do that, Jim. See what they're up to, man. Don't do this. Don't mess this up. It's like the being you're a prisoner for all these years, and now they're giving you some little freedoms here. Privileges, but major to me. They took the box, and I'll never forget one of them. He took it and he pushed it forward in those bony, thin fingers as he pushed the box forward towards me. And then I just said, "What the hell is that?" I'm a person. That's the way I talked. And they go, "It's a gift for you." And I said, "Well, what do you want me to do with it?" And they do with it as you will. And then they turned around and they walked out the room. I looked at the box. I didn't want to touch it at first. I didn't know if it would shock me to death. I didn't know what it would be. And I touched it with my finger. It didn't hurt me. And I picked it up with my hand, and I started turning it around in all directions. It just was a square, perfectly square box, absorbent black. And so I started pulling on it to see if it had a lid, and it wouldn't open. I started pulling real hard, and it wouldn't open. I took it, and I wedged it between my feet. Yeah, on the floor, and I was pulling hard, and I couldn't get it to open. Then I grabbed it with my hand, and I held it over my head, and I was about to smash it on the table, and this telepathic voice said, "You didn't try opening it gently. Open it gently." And I went like, duh, to myself. And so I took it, and I just barely put pressure. I put my hand around it, and I started pulling on it, and it opened.
Popped right open, huh?
Right open. Now, here's what I didn't expect when I looked in it. It's all these surprises. First thing when I opened it was it smelled rancid. This horrific, horrible smell. Inside of it was about 3 or 4 inches of thick black tar. And the best way I can describe that, it looked like asphalt tar that they would put on your roof when it's hot.
Yeah, okay.
And there were glass tubes sticking out of it of all different assortment and sizes, almost like test tubes, but they weren't. They were just tubes in it in sequence. Well, it's almost like alchemy. I later learned that later. And I went, what the hell kind of gift is this? It smelled bad. What the hell is this? And they said, it's your gift. It's your gift. We extracted it from your lungs.
Oh, my God. Was it a tumor?
No, man. I smoked like a chimney in those days.
Oh,
you know, I smoke, and I don't know if you've ever smoked, George, but
No, I never did.
Thank God for you. Thank God for that. I mean, because I've gone back and forth with that in my life, and at that time I was really a heavy smoker, so they extracted all the garbage out of my lungs. Things are evolving now. But phenomenally enough to me, I made up that word, phenomenally. Phenomenally enough for me, I got to see a technology, and it's had me thinking to this day, and I know if I were to ever team up with the right people that understand things like this, that they somehow can vaporize matter where it's gently removed, like as if it were a tumor. In this case, it was tar and garbage from my lungs, and it vaporizes, and it's attracted to those tubes in that box. So it just slowly is extracted from the body without being intrusive.
And then it forms again?
It's gone. That's right. Now, I can tell you a little bit about what I've learned about implants. I'm going somewhere I don't normally go either. Something I was going to write about for, I am writing about. But you know, you've heard of abductees having implants.
Yes. Such.
Well, what they can do is they can beam a pattern into the flesh, and whatever the instrument they want it to be. Let's say they just want it to be, I'm going to make it simple, something silly and simple. Let's say they wanted an instrument in you that could pick up your brain thoughts or your voice thoughts, okay, and then transmit out to a receiver wherever they are. There's enough elements in your body. There's enough raw material in your bloodstream for conductivity, whether it be the mercury, whether it be the metals in the body, because when they beam it to a certain part, let's say they want to put it in your calf, or they want to put it in the back of your arm or the bottom of your arm, and they point something that's almost like a laser, you really can't see the light, it goes inside and it starts telling, it instructs the inside of your flesh to start gathering the materials necessary to literally and biologically build this implant for whatever they want it to do. So there's enough metals, there's enough conductive materials, there's enough minerals, there's enough in your body to make a little working apparatus that has feelers that go into the flesh from the inside, and there's enough electrical power in our body to power it. So that's why they're not making incisions from the outside. They're not things that I've seen that I can explain. That's why there's no bacterial growth, or the body doesn't reject it, because it's stuff that's already in your body. Now, when you go under surgery and they try to cut these things out, like you've read and stuff that they do, it immediately makes them inoperative. In other words, it takes all the whatever the materials, the raw materials from the body it used to extract, it's an exacting detail to make a working diode or instrument. It balls it up in either to something that might be a little piece of metal, something that might be a piece of another material, where you can't really figure out how to work the thing. So it solidifies it into something solid. So when you cut it out, it makes it inoperable. So it's a pretty cool technology. Again, it's advanced. So they're not necessarily slicing you open, sticking the thing in there, and sewing you up. They're actually creating it within the materials within your body. So these are the things, you know, I started to see, and these are some of the things I picked up. Now, I have this newfound freedom. I blacked out again, and I went the hard way, and I got home. Now, things are evolving even further. I get pulled again. And this is all within the 6-year period.
Always in bed?
No, I could be driving in my car. God, one time when my wife was with me, we were driving in the car, and at times they would manipulate her to get me to do something. We were driving along. My wife wasn't violent or crazy like this, but we were driving at the time I was married. And she said, "Pull the car over, Jim." And I said, "Why?" I said, "Pull the car over," which was not like her. So I'm still driving, like, "What are you talking about?" And she started screaming at me, "Pull that car over," and grabbed the steering wheel. And the car was swaying on the highway. And, it, you know, of course, it scared me, and I pulled the car over. When I pulled the car over to the side, that loud, whirling, whipping sound, you know, Teresa slumped into the seat and blacked out. That loud, whirling, whipping sound came into my head, and that sensation I told you of being pulled. And I got pulled. So, no, not necessarily when I'm laying in bed. That's a fact. I could be sitting up watching television. I could be laying on the sofa. I could be sitting at the table. But a lot of it did happen between the hours of, like, 2 and 4 in the morning. But it always stood to reason to me why. Because if you were going to be studying wild lions in their natural setting, are you going to go study them or try to abduct them or tranquilize them while they're feeding in the middle of the day, or are you going to do it when they're asleep in their little coats?
Exactly. Was there a point, Jim, when you started to realize, what are they doing with me?
Yeah.
What do they want with me?
But that's what this is leading to, because another event took place where I got pulled again, and now I wasn't laying in this, you know, paralyzed in this room. I was in another room, and I was standing up, and it was like, wow, I'm standing up. Here I am again, you know, and I'm not going to mess up. So all that the hatred and with focused anger was concentrated on, what are these guys up to? So I'm standing up in this room. There's two gurneys, and two grays walk in, and telepathically said, "Could you please lay in this gurney?" Now, that was another first, George. Instead of being paralyzed and finding myself with semen being extracted and all these other things, They asked me to do it.
Right. They wanted you to just willfully do it.
Do it. And I said, okay. And I did. Now, they did screen image something that looked like something I enjoyed at first to prompt me to do it. I don't need to go into a lot of that detail, but they screen image it to look like a gaming table in Vegas at first, like I was going to play dice or something. It was really crazy. And I shook that one off because I've learned how to shake off the screen imaging, and I just cooperated, and I laid on the table. Now, in that session, and this was not uncommon, here's what the screen imaging that they would create. You're laying in this bed.
Your detail, by the way, is absolutely amazing.
Well, thank you for that. And I told myself day after day, hour after hour, week after week, month after month, year after year, that I was going to memorize everything I could. And I went over and over and over it. They would not allow me to write those first 6 years. I was not allowed. If I went home and wrote down anything that I experienced, you know how they would punish me when I got pulled again?
What would they do?
I would be in that room. I would be sitting in that chair paralyzed, and they would ignore me for hours. And towards the end of time to go, they'd go, you're not supposed to write anything down. If I wrote down a symbol, if I wrote anything later, you know, just when I would get back home, they would ignore me for hours. That was the punishment for doing it. But one day, towards the end of the 6 year, which I'm about to lead to, is when they said, go ahead and write. And I did. But leading to that, here I am in this room, and they came in to lay in this gurney. Now I'm laying in the gurney, and this is a screen image. I'm laying in the gurney, and it's almost as if I'm in a bedroom and I'm laying on a bed. And I'm on my back, and I'm propped up at about a 45-degree angle, like one of those beds that can, you know, electronically come up a little bit.
Sure.
And the door opens up, which I should have known was phony because doors don't open up on board, but I went along with it. And two of the most drop-dead gorgeous women that I've ever laid my eyes in walk into the room. Gee, what a coincidence. They happen to look exactly like what I think would be perfect, right?
Sounds like the movie Weird Science. You concocted them yourself.
I guess I did. I never saw that movie. And another thing I must tell you, and people that know me, is I've dedicated myself to not watching movies, since this has been going on, anything associated with the science fiction, the alien abductions scenario, and read little to know of others' material, only not to cloud my experiences and to keep it separate. So
hey, Jim, we're at the top of the hour, so let's take this quick break. We'll come back and let you finish up on that again, and then we'll get into just what mission they have for you. And then we'll take phone calls as well. Another hour to go. Jim Sparks, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Sparks, they're lining up to talk with you, but I still have a few quick questions here. At what point did you pick up on the message,
Sure. What
they wanted with you?
It was when they realized I wasn't going to kill them or tear the ship up. There was a mass abduction. I had found myself in a clearing in the woods. There was a pile of people standing under me, about a dozen or 15. To my left was two more piles of people with a gray standing in each group. I was standing up. They were in people that were primarily mostly paralyzed. The first telepathic message to me was calm them. There was a guy standing up. He was able to stand. There was one other than me standing, but mostly paralyzed. And I was telling him he was going to be okay. He was going to be fine. The sickness or the nausea, his feeling will pass. That he was feeling will pass. There was a woman laying on the ground, and she was in the fetal position rocking. And I put my hand on her shoulder, and I was telling her she was going to be fine, not knowing what was going on, because here again, you'd get no advance notice, at least in those days, as to what was about to proceed.
Sure.
I went into a little bit of detail as to what they did with me, and then the next telepathic voice was, no, you're telling her too much, just calm her. I calmed her. And it was an overcast evening. The clearing in the woods was about the size of a football field. There were three lights glowing in the horizon. They were ships. One, real quick, came over my pile of people. The second one hovered real quick and came over the second pile of group of people. And the third one came over the third group of people. When it descended through the clouds, the one over my group descended first. Everything was orderly. I saw for the first time what one of their craft looked like from the outside. a beam of light, a white, bright beam of light with a hue of blue, cast itself over myself and my group of people. And then a white beam of light came out of the second and the third ship over that those piles of people. That was a mass abduction. That was a gathering point, or one particular gathering point for a mass abduction that ended up having nearly 1,000 people on board. It was phenomenal. When the light was beaming out and I was looking at the craft, it was spherical. It had a dome on the top, but it had an egg-shaped droop on the bottom of it, and around that egg-shaped thing were windows. This is where I started seeing military personnel, and these abductions as they later went on, military personnel working with grays, not hiding their faces from me, a lot of them with rank, telling me the story. But anyway, in this particular scene, this is where it all started opening up. As that light beamed down, I walked forward from that pile or group of people, and I had my arms in the air, and I was just screaming out, "It's beautiful, it's beautiful. They're all beautiful." And then I blacked out. When I had regained consciousness, I found myself in a corridor with all these people that were on the ground standing up. They were zombie-like. And the next telepathic instructions to me were, lead them. And in front of me in this corridor, when I took a step, the group of people took a step. When I stopped, they stopped. So whatever I did, they did. And they were completely out of it. They were mostly naked or in their night clothes, so you could see that these people were pulled while they were sleeping. The corridor opened up to this humongous room about the size of a basketball gymnasium. It was lined up with rows and rows and rows and rows and rows of monitors, hundreds of them. At the end of this room were grays, military personnel scurrying around, messing around with instruments, mass abduction. The next telepathic instructions to me were to seat them. I took the first person that was near me and put his hand on top of mine, which was on top of mine while I was walking the group anyway, and went all the way down to the end of the one row, sat him down in his cubicle where there was a monitor, not still knowing what the hell these people were up to or these beings. As I started walking halfway back, I stopped to look again. I wanted to see what the hell was going on, so I started looking at everything in detail, the human beings, the grays, like, what is going on in this place? And then the telepathic voice strongly said, no. I kept looking, and it kept going, no, no, one-word commands. I disobeyed. I blacked out. When I came to, I found myself seated in front of a monitor, and several hundred people, up to 1,000, during that blackout period, were seated in front of their monitors. The room lit up in one glow, so you could tell that every monitor was had the same visual on it, like going to when they sell televisions and there's 20 TVs in the glass window. You could see it was all at the same time. There was a hum. And by the way, I should mention that there were lines hooked into each one of us, either in our calves or it was hooked into the back of our arms, which I think explains a lot of scoop marks. These lines were feeding something into us to make us extremely attentive, extremely emotional, and extremely attuned and alert to color and emotional stimuli. But there was a reason for it. Now the picture started coming into place. The first scene that appeared on all these monitors was just a drop-dead, gorgeous, beautiful Earth scene that absolutely took your breath away. It was the ocean. It was blue as blue could be, turquoise blue. It was teeming with fish.
A pristine planet.
Yes. The air was, like, perfect. And all you could do, no matter who you were, even if you were a non-emotional individual, from what was hooked into you and from what you've seen, and you knew that that was from way in the distant past, all you could do was go, God, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. You almost wanted to cry with its beauty. There was a hum, a three-second blackout on the screen, and then another Earth scene would come up, and I remember the second one specifically. It was mountains in the background with snow on the top of them, beautiful trees. It was a gorgeous lake. And again, you're just going, oh, my God, it's so beautiful. And it was one beautiful Earth scene after the other after the other. Then the Earth scene started getting ugly, where where the ocean was beautiful. It was a dingy gray, where the fish were teeming and alive, filled with energy. They were bloated, floating on top of the water. The air was bloated. And the reverse happened to you. Now, but as each one of these uglier earth scenes started appearing, the telepathic loud in your head said, as each scene came on, you're killing your planet. Your planet is dying. You're killing your planet. Your planet is dying. When I blacked out towards the end of that, and I hated it. Of course, everybody that was watching it hated it. But what I didn't know at the time, what I do know now, because I've seen these things many times over, is they're enhancing your awareness of the condition of the planet, what it was, where we're going, and what you can do when in the globe when it reaches critical mass as to solve the problem. There is a plan, there is a solution, and there is a way to do it. When I regained consciousness again, I was in this thing akin to a locker room. And in this locker room area, where clothes were sprawled all over the place, people were moaning and groaning and crying because whatever tubes they had stuck in their arm or whatever stuck in their calves or their legs just scared them. The telepathic instructions to me, again, were to calm them, and I was walking up to different individuals saying that, look, any cut or any wound you get on board here heals fast. The memory is taken away from all these. The physical memory of what took place is taken away except for what was ingrained or enhanced and implanted in these people's minds. On a more humorous note, before the end of this experience, mass abduction, the telepathic voice said to all of us, nobody leaves, and I'll never forget, it was funny. Nobody gets to leave until they find their exact clothes. Well, you've never seen so many people switch from gear from moaning and groaning to scurrying all over the place and clothes flying in the air to wanting to find their clothes. And then we were brought back. Okay, now, approximately within a few weeks or a month later, I get pulled again. Now, you can see how this is evolving, correct, George? Now we're in the seventh year, the eighth year.
Right. There's a pattern to this.
Oh, God, yeah, and it gets great. That's why, look, I formed a foundation. It's in its infancy. It's called Your Earth. We're putting together a thing called a pack, where if people with interest in this, what I've learned about abductees, and when I do lectures and I talk, what I've learned, George, is I ask these questions. I go, if I say to you the rainforest, what comes to mind? And almost every one of them, without exception, has this deep wanting in them to do something about it. It's as if it's implanted in all of us that have had these abduction experiences, that acutely aware, acutely sensitive. And I know there's a plan, and this is where the reptilian thing is going to come in, and I don't want to sound scary with them, but it was fascinating with interaction there. But I did put together on the when I wrote the book, and when we did the DVD that Linda Howe was talking about earlier,
yes,
we put that together, so not only can you read and learn, it's on the gym-sparks.com or the gym-sparks.com, but there'll be a place in there. We did a special put together for your program, so it's a lot less money, and they can get a picture of what the story is in detail and what one can do. But later on, I got pulled again, and see, these things are involved. I'm going to do the best I can to get in with the time we got, George.
And we've got people stacked up to talk with you too, Jimmy.
I'll talk about this one thing, and then we can go for that.
All right.
I find myself again, this time, in what appeared to be an abandoned carnival yard. I don't think a carnival had anything to do with it. It was at night. When I regained consciousness, I was standing up, and there was an old dilapidated roller coaster. There were about 9 to 12 beings, and they were totally different from the grays that I'd ever seen, ever seen. They were anywhere from 7 to 9 feet tall. They had huge, broad shoulders and a broad chest. They were just big, and they had scales on them. And I even commented, I said, oh, my God, you have scales. Now, what people commonly refer these things to as reptilians, but these things were benign and kind. They had emotions. As I was standing there, the 9 or 10 of them were staring at one of them, transmitting his thoughts to this one being, and he created a hologram of a human face in front of his face, so he could talk to me without me being scared as to how they looked. because their brains protruded over their brow, and the scales were on top of that, and they were kind of lumpy, so they had a scary appearance. Even though it didn't scare me, I'd seen so many things. And the first thing they came out and said was, after all these years, that you had to go through what you went through so you could fully understand and appreciate what we're doing here. We went to global leaders. We went to world leaders. We went to people in power. They did the right protocol. We gave technology to stop using nuclear weapons, biological weapons. We gave free energy devices. We gave energy for your longevity. We gave energy, I mean technology for your longevity. I didn't mean to say energy. I meant technology for energy. We gave the technology for to clean up your sea, to clean up the rainforest, and all this stuff. And what the power people did with this stuff around the globe was made weapons and made money with this stuff. So they completely dishonored the agreements. They went on further to say that, unfortunately, and their hands have nothing to do with this, they went on to say that people have been maimed, murdered, and killed in the last 50, 60 years for the sake of national security, to keep this stuff secret. They had nothing to do with it. And then the next thing out of their mouth, or out of his telepathic brain mouth, so to speak, while this hologram was moving lips that were not in sequence with the telepathic things he was saying, which was kind of funny, was the fact that the cure-all for this thing is amnesty. And I had never heard of any disclosure programs at that point. I told you I didn't read on any of this thing. Complete and 100% amnesty, meaning that totally 100% forgivable, not forced disclosure, but amnesty, to create an avenue where people in black ops, people in sanctioned and non-sanctioned agencies who keep this technology secret, legally and illegally, in both cases, a lot of this stuff is tied to a lot of our defense, and a lot of our technologies that are 20, 30, 40 years out there that the general public cannot know,
right,
that they do not want to disclose. So what they want to see is to create an avenue that if they come forward with the things that will help the human species to evolve, that there will be no recourse. Because what the main concern is, and again, because of time, I haven't been able to get into this. I've had abductions in underground bases with military personnel. I've had abductions with above-ground bases with military personnel, with these different groups of aliens involved. They've never hidden their face. They've never hidden their rank. They've been very clear about that there's a growing majority that wants to come forward with this stuff to rescue this planet. However, what they're afraid of more than anything is, what will you do to me? And this amnesty would stop them from being prosecuted. It would stop them from being convicted. Full 100% forgivable amnesty. Not for spiritual reasons, but more for practical reasons. Now, what phenomenalized me, and again, that's a word I made up, but was the fact that when I started speaking at these conferences, people would say, well, have you ever heard of what this group is doing? Did you ever read about what this group is doing or what that group is doing as far as disclosure is concerned and so forth? And so finally I dabbled into it before we put the Your Earth thing together and the pack that we're doing, that for people who have an interest in doing something in a voice, and we're not going to be politically radicals, but we're going to do it, and we're doing it in a legitimate way. What I saw were the words in their mission statements on a lot of these things were like almost the exact word-for-word stuff that these beings had said. I've since then interacted with so many different ETs, and it's evolved to the point where I don't get pulled like I used to. I'm told where to go. I meet them in secluded places. The craft will come down. Maybe another show, George, to get into that detail. But however, what I'm seeing is something very similar in words that floored me to what these guys had to say with these scaled-like creatures, okay, that are obviously working in conjunction with these grays. What they also went on to say was a lot of human beings are using the technology to get their way with women, bad people, raping and stuff like that, and mimicking themselves as what we would call a reptilian, and that's why they're getting a lot of the bad rap. But fascinatingly enough, and because they're emotional, they had feeling, all the little personal things they said. But anyway, this there's a lot of similarities. But what I'm seeing here is where we're going to be a little bit different is your Earth is going to concentrate on the rainforest. Your Earth is it's a mission. Its intentions are to buy Amazonian and rainforest land. The next step is, and I got this from not just Jim, so bear in mind that it's high intelligent beings from other worlds, to put in on this property the Indians that are indigenous to this land, to be stewards of it. The third part of these instructions is for the ones who've been thrashing and burning it for inadequate housing and not rotating crop, and they keep going, for their labors in restoring this stuff, the rainforest and Amazonian land, they get a plot of land, and they're taught how to farm it properly. It's given it to them for their labors in restoring, also adequate housing. Now, where this involves the amnesty is, this will be the first time that the globe or the human species on a global basis will have a hands-on project to turning something environmentally around. What these people in Black Op are going to see and what these people in the sanctioned and non-sanctioned agencies know that there's technologies to speed up this process. They want to come out with this.
So it seems, though, that this was all tied into some kind of save the planet movement over all these years. All right, Jim, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. As promised, your phone calls when we come back. Okay, let's go to the phones with our guest, Jim Sparks. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey.
Yeah, go for it.
All right. Well, my name's Chase. I'm from Arkansas, and
okay.
I'm traveling through Alabama right now. And I basically want to talk to you about this thing that's kind of been happening to me for the past couple years. It started out, I'm laying in bed with my girlfriend. And so basically I think she's, you know, like touching me. So I wake up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I wake up, she's not touching me. And I kind of see this thing hide behind a bookshelf in my room. And I can't, it's really hard to describe, but it's kind of like it notices that I notice it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really take like any kind of like alien form, shape, or anything like that. It's the only way I can really describe it is kind of like a nervous system, except it's kind of made out of, you know, like maybe dead sticks or something, you know, and it's kind of limber. And so it's kind of, you know, it sees it, I see it, it's kind of pulsating and coming towards me. And so at this point I'm sitting up and I'm pointing at it and, you know, asking my girlfriend if she sees it, and I'm kind of freaked out, you know. And then finally it just gets right in my face until, you know, I basically just scream, and then it's gone.
Well, don't hang up the phone for a second because I want to ask you a question. Have you ever had UFO sightings?
No.
Okay. Have you ever had trauma in your life where trauma meaning that maybe something close to near death, or have you ever had where you were abused? And I'm not trying to say people that are abused see things, but something where that high trauma in your life in those areas?
Nothing really comes to mind, no.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask that is because what I've learned over the years, because of these grays in particular, use a technology to travel from one dimension to the other. Earlier in the show, I had mentioned, Chase, that I have seen other entities in these places. Also, what I've learned over the years is that people who've been traumatized or been sometimes sexually abused and that kind of trauma, it's like they're traumatized to the point where they actually leave this reality temporarily to cope with it, and then they connect with other beings that may be in another reality or another dimension, and sometimes these things keep coming back. I know that in the early years also, that's why I asked you those questions. Also in the early years that I went through the abduction scenario, in essence, it's kind of the way that that started off for me. It was dreamlike at first, and then they started making these appearances. But I don't want to make a judgment call, but what I think I'm hearing here is that you're having some kind of interaction with another other interdimensional being that for some reason has some interest in you.
It does not sound to me like it's an extraterrestrial, Jim.
Right, exactly. An interdimensional being.
Yeah, something else is going on there.
I agree with you, George.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
What do I start with?
At the beginning.
Right. That could be a long story. I was listening to your, this whole thing. I said, this is Elizabeth from New Mexico, by the way. And hit a lot of nerves for me with that. I'm really nervous right now. And it's having weird stuff like this, as you've been talking about, kind of going on since I was at least five. And lately it's been kind of getting, I wouldn't say worse, but I've been more remembering things lately.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering have you ever seen ones that are robed? Do you know what kind they are?
Did you say robed?
They're short. I remember seeing them. It was mainly when I first moved here, and I was about 14 or 15. They were kind of robed, and something was there. But those ones stopped for a while. Now I've been seeing what you're describing, as grays. Like last night, but...
So you've been abducted on a regular basis, then?
Yeah.
You said your name was Elizabeth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, okay, for starters, have I seen robed beings? Yes. 95% of interaction has been with what are commonly referred to grays, probably what would take up... almost three to the other 5% would be what are commonly referred to as reptilians, different species. And on occasion, I have seen human-looking beings that do wear robes. But then later on, you said that as things have evolved in your abduction experiences, that you're starting to have memories of gray. So now I'm going to ask you, like I asked the other gentleman, Chase, Elizabeth, when I bring up something like the rainforest or when I bring up something like environmental woes, do you feel led in any way or you feel like you may be on a mission or something like that where you feel like when that day may come where there's something you can do about these things or be a part of helping out?
Well, since I was a kid, I've always been about nature and stuff. I actually had a lot of weird experiences. I used to live in California, and I could almost, feel earthquakes before mm-hmm. they happened. Mm-hmm. And I get really sick after them. And I've always been one for – my friend's trying to get me into PETA, but PETA's a little too extreme.
Do all abductees, Jim, have that feeling like you do about ecological help?
I'm seeing that, George. I really am. As a matter of fact, because of the shortage of time, I'm usually, I guess I don't know the word coy. I'd be a bit more coy or subtle, where I would just ask certain questions that don't appear to be leading in that direction. But what I'm finding, better than 95% of the time, there seems to be a passion for it. And it does not surprise me from what I've seen over the years. And it's a lot of the reason I ask it. Again.
So you're saying Al Gore's been abducted?
It's very possible.
You never know.
It's very, very possible they take the physical memory away. A lot of the interactions are, they can be really, really pleasant. Here's another thing I've learned in line with this. That's why I asked if you've seen UFOs. This is what I mean by this. Let's say you're a person and it's driving along in your car, and you literally see a physical UFO. You don't know yourself as being an abductee, nothing of that nature. Now, I know through experience, and others will tell you, that these beings can manipulate time. They have the technology to do it. Henceforth comes the term missing time when it comes to abductions. So in some cases with sightings, because I've seen this and experienced it with my own eyes, these people have been abducted. They're on board, and the process may go on for an hour, 2 hours, or more. But the interaction was very pleasant, because there's a lot of cases where they're extremely pleasant. They weren't traumatized. They weren't scared. They were enhanced by what's going on the globe and how the human species can evolve. Questions were asked in some cases and got answered. So the whole two-hour or three-hour experience was a very pleasant one. Towards the end of the experience, the ET will say, "I'm sorry, we have to take the physical memory away from you from what just took place, because it will get in the way of your life instead of the things that you can do to enhance the human species evolving and your part in it when the time is right." Now, these people, in a lot of cases, when it's pleasant, will go, "No, don't do that, please. I want to remember all of this. This was great. Don't take it away from me." Here's where ET compromises, and they do this. They'll say, "We'll put you back in your car where we found you originally, where we abducted you. You will get to see us leave. So you'll be in your car. You will not have a memory that you just had an abduction experience, but what you will be able to see is this object in the sky and us leaving." So it doesn't surprise me, and what I've learned over the years, again, I'll ask people, "Have you ever physically seen a UFO, even if they don't think they've been in the abduction scenario?" Not to lead them there, and then I start asking these key questions when time allows, and I find, again, they're overwhelmed by wanting or feeling that they have a mission or something to do with the environment and with even with this amnesty thing I'm finding. Again, that's why I did this thing with the book and the DVD at the jim-sparks.com, because what I'm going to be doing, what we're doing with that, is I'm giving an email address out on that where you can write in a paragraph or so where you may feel led to do, or what you may feel led to do, but to even more so to answer your questions, your question regarding people that way. I had even did a blind thing when I go to conferences and have given out this a particular email address saying, "Write a paragraph of people who are abductees, what you feel led you should do." And again, better than 90% of the time, it comes into this environmental issue. So it's there's meat there. It's real.
Okay, let's take a few more calls. Time is quickly clicking by. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, me?
Yes, you.
Okay, I'm Tommy from Seattle, and Mr. Sparks, I wish to tell you that I've had experiences that parallel yours exactly to about 80%. The main difference being no punishment, no sexual abuse, and no learning. My first experience with these aliens that came into my toy shop was in May of 1992. They're 5-foot-high tall grays, and I've asked them a number of questions, and I would like to get your opinion on the answers they gave me. The first thing I would say was, what did they know about the grays? And they said that they ran into a reptilian colony 60 million years ago that was supposedly from Earth when they first developed their interstellar drive. That's one point. The second thing I asked them was, if you had evolved from a creature on Earth, what would that be? And they replied, termites. Okay, and then I asked them how they did invisibility, and it turns out that their uniforms are infested with micro-artificially intelligent technology. They go a quarter second into the future to achieve invisibility, and mostly as a defense weapon from projectile weapons. And then I asked them about interstellar propulsion, and they said that they do gravity compression where time is suspended to go instantly from one place to the other, and that they use this for communications. And there was an instance where an artificial life form at one time used it as a weapon, and it was immediately eliminated because of that. And I will listen silently for your answer.
Okay. But one must bear this in mind, and this is what I also what I've learned over the years, Tommy, is the fact that there are about as many species of extraterrestrials with high technology as there are diversity of life on this planet. My primary interaction has been, as I mentioned earlier, has been with the grays and a little bit with what these scaled creatures are. When it comes to the galactic neighborhood and the different species, there's different technologies, but there's a uniformity there, meaning that once one a species or a race crosses a line, then this business with warring, this business with competition, this business with killing each other, this all this other stuff is held at bay. A lot of technologies are similar. A lot of them are extremely different, but they're all doing their own agenda. You'll never hear me say that I claim to embrace alien culture and hug them as my space brothers. What I do know about them is that they have agendas here on this planet, and they just assume not see a messed up planet that's environmentally destroyed as we would. So here we have a common goal. Yes, time is manipulated. There's no doubt about it. Due to lack of time, you could read about it in my work, or maybe George will have me on again. I can tell a nice story about how I was abducted for 2 hours, and when they brought me back, 2 to 3 minutes before I left. And in that scenario, I actually saw myself again. I saw my other self, and it was a phenomena how one phase of time did not interfere with the other phase of time. So that may play a part about how you said they go ahead a quarter second to create this invisibility factor. But once again, there's as much variety in technology and species as there are life form varieties on this planet.
Let's take this wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, it's Bob from Burbank.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, you have one of the top guests on your show right now, the one of the most exciting guys, Jim Sparks, man. God, his story is incredible, and it parallels with a lot of people that have had these experiences out there. Myself, I was with some police officers, and this is one I want to say this one story, and then I ask you a question that's really important. That I was with these police officers, and we all got this orange orb came down, and did some weird. There are humans in this. They weren't aliens in this, because we heard them talking in English, and I saw the silhouettes of these people. But an orange orb came down, and did some medical experiments on myself and three other officers. And one officer was smart enough to put in a report. Obviously, he lost his job. That was a smart thing to do. But what I was saying to them, I said, you know, maybe it's the CIA abducting us and put all these implants in our, you know, just hypnotized us and made us think this stuff happened. But that was that one incident. But my main question when I asked Jim Sparks is this. In California, the last few months, people have gotten high-resolution photographs of these dragonfly drones. And the writing on the drones.
I apologize. Say that sentence again. I didn't hear it. It broke up a little. Something about drones. Would you repeat?
People are seeing these drones all over California.
Okay.
Yes. Can you still hear me?
I can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I've talked to some people on international phone calls about this. My phone line gets cut sometimes. So I'm going to tell you, the letters that you've been seeing, have you seen the writing on the drones? Did they match?
I like that question. Because I'm really specific.
A minute to go, Jim. Go ahead.
I'm very specific about this aspect of it. I was the block lettering and also our number system was translated into a specific symbolic form that's unique in its own. And there's no question I recognize that whenever I see it. And a lot of times people will present these different things in front of me, and I'm always very candid and very upfront with it because I would like to oblige and say, yes, that's something I've seen when it's not. And one out of 20 or two out of 20 instances, something is presented to me in that form, and I clearly recognize those symbols. I have seen people have emailed me and showed me those drones, and I'm not specifically seeing anything in symbolic form that I can say I can relate to in interaction with the particular beings that I've been dealing with.
Jim, I want to thank you. Would very quickly get your website out, would you please?
It's jim-sparks.com or jim-sparks.com, whichever you're more comfortable with. It's the dash in the middle. And as I said, it shows how you get involved. You can get the book, you can get the DVD, and we put a nice package together, and we cut the price down just for your audience.
All right, very good. Thank you, Jim. And I've got to tell you, very riveting story about the Keepers, an alien message for the human race. I mean, we've heard different angles, but this one is a first, that they are basically out there to save us. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.